This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Well, as you know, it's the election season. We've got a midterm election coming up in November, and there's lots of talk about candidates and issues and, you know, politics. And we've been talking with all the statewide candidates here on Main Street, and today we are very pleased to have with us Kelly Armstrong. He is the Republican candidate for U.S. House of Representatives, and he joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right into it. Why are you running for this office?
You know, I love this state. I grew up in Dickinson. I lived in Grand Forks for 10 years. I moved back to Dickinson in 2006, and I've been out of the state twice. The longest I've made it out of here is 9 months, and it's just something that I think I can do well. And now more than ever, I think we need somebody advocating in D.C. for the things that are good for North Dakota, because what's good for North Dakota is good for the country.
Well, what are the major issues in your campaign?
The major issues are the general overall theme is to make sure that we let North Dakotans determine North Dakota destiny. The more we can keep the federal government out of overbearing regulation and allow our farmers, our energy producers, and our small businessmen to do what they do best, and that's unleash the North Dakota economy, the better off we can be. So one thing that's been really cool as we've gone from one end of the state to the other during this campaign is people in North Dakota are proud of what they produce. And it's that the same way we campaign will be the same way we advocate for North Dakota in D.C. And that's, you know, especially in the House where it turns over every 2 years, oftentimes before you're even advocating for an issue, you have to educate people on the issue. And if you're if you represent an urban area, you might not care about our wheat crop, but you care about the cost of a loaf of bread.
Well, I think people care about the cost of soybeans right now, too.
So they do.
So let's talk about the expanding trade war and its effect on a very important market in the state.
Yeah, obviously North Dakota is a commodity-based economy. Tariffs are not a good solution for what we do here. That being said, we need to work for better trade deals, and we need to get better trade deals not just for this generation of farmers, but also for the next generation of farmers. We've said since the beginning of this campaign that the administration needs to understand how high the stakes are for North Dakota. And even during the course of this, given the pulpit you have as a candidate, we've had the opportunity to express that to the administration and to other members of Congress as well, because even though the economy nationwide is doing great right now, I mean, the lowest unemployment in over 10 years, highest wage growth in over 10 years, stock market's at an all-time high, consumer confidence is at an all-time high. But we know in ag country that when we start feeling the pain, the rest of the country is going to feel it within 18 to 36 months. I mean, that's just been proven out through the course of time. So we need to get some trade deals negotiated. They need to be better than they were in the past, but we need to get some progress moving quickly.
Well, how confident are you that there will be progress quickly? I mean, are the soybean farmers a poker chip here?
I think the answer to that is there's China and there's everything else. And I think the Chinese situation is, I mean, we're moving towards different deals, but we need to continue to negotiate with them. But farmers in North Dakota need a win. We need a farm bill. We need E15. People on the ground are willing to give this, I mean, a little bit of time, but we have to see some progress somewhere. And that's, I think, the frustrating thing with people, whether you're growing soybeans, corn, or wheat right now.
Well, you mentioned the state's relationship with the federal government, and it isn't all one way. I mean, we've got two air bases here, and we've got, as you mentioned, a farm bill, which has very important provisions for this commodity, piece of our economy. So what are you really saying about the federal government?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously when you're talking about the two air bases, and I think one of the things that's been great about General Mattis coming into this administration is he doesn't just view our theaters of engagement in what we are doing now, but also in how we do them in the future. And obviously with two legs of the triad and Minot and the bomber and the bombers that they have there, and also the repurposing and, you know, doing the drone technology and things of that out of the Grand Forks Air Base. We're centrally located. We're strategically placed, and we need to ensure that those bases continue to be a part of the conversation as we move forward.
Well, let's move on to another issue that is sort of red hot nationally and in North Dakota, and that is the Affordable Care Act. It has been an issue, but certainly with Congressman Kramer a year ago or so, and it will probably be an issue if you are successful in your bid. Why do you favor North Dakota's participation in the Texas lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act?
I think the failure of Obamacare has been a bipartisan issue, and it started since 2010 when it was introduced. And the reality of the situation is the federal government has proven that they are incapable of doing this in a way that keeps costs down and continues to deliver care. I love our state, but I would much rather have plans more like the Graham-Cassidy bill, which allows more money to come to North Dakota with less federal strings attached. I'm just significantly more comfortable with John Gottfried, our insurance commissioner, and Governor Doug Burgum making health care decisions for North Dakota than I am the federal government.
Well, I'm covered by Medicare, and I have to say it's a big improvement over what I used to be under. So why the bugaboo about the Affordable Care Act? Why not simply fix what you think is wrong with it? Why throw everything out?
The short answer is because they've had eight years to fix anything that's wrong, and it doesn't continue to move forward.
Well,
and
so have Republicans. I mean, this isn't just a Democrat thing.
No, I agree completely. It's a bipartisan failure at the federal level, in a lot of ways, Obamacare was trying to fix something that wasn't broken in North Dakota. Prior to its implementation, 7 to 10% of the population was uninsured. After its implementation, 7 to 10% of the population is still uninsured. All we have done is shift the burden farther up the chain. And what we've done is, while we've covered more people, which is great, and I want as many people to have coverage as possible, we've also created a situation where the rising cost of healthcare on the private market has made it impossible for other people to continue to maintain health insurance. And those are our farmers and our small businessmen. And we've really just shifted it from one end to down truly on Main Street in North Dakota.
Well, you've identified the people who pay the bills, you know, us. who benefits from the health care industry that we're talking about here? Who benefits from returning to the status quo, if you will?
Well, I think if we go back to – I mean, if we allow North Dakotans to make those decisions, I think the North Dakota citizens are the ones who benefit. We're a great state. Obviously, I love this state, but we have 750,000 people. We're essentially a suburb of Chicago. The more we can get that money, the money that is associated to North or dedicated to North Dakota back to North Dakota without federal strings attached, the better off we will be.
Let's talk about one more issue here. The energy and oil development of the state, you have a family connection to that. You're vice president of the Armstrong Corporation, I believe. They're talking about building a refinery within the viewscape of the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually just to the west of my home district. And
yes,
I can tell you in southwest North Dakota, that is people are excited about it. It'll bring jobs, it'll bring industry, and it'll bring a lot of things. And I think provided they comply with all of the parameters of state law, they should be allowed to build it.
So you're fine with what's going on right now? You don't see a need for a more extensive environmental impact study?
I'm always fine with businesses being allowed to move forward if they've complied with what the statutes say they should comply with.
When I went up on your website, I'm talking with Kelly Armstrong, Republican candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. I see a lot of emphasis on the word conservative and true conservative being defined up there. Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, it's one, as an old state party chair, there's two words that I've never thought should be a bad word. One is establishment and the other is conservative. And I believe that because I think we North Dakotans are conservative in their business. They're conservative in how they do things. When they can afford something, they buy it. When they can't afford something, they don't buy it. And that's more. And if there's nothing else that we take to Washington, that is that mantra. I mean, we need to determine the difference between needs and wants. We have a $23 trillion deficit, and we need to start having serious conversations, because sooner or later that debt's going to come due. And if we don't start working on real solutions to those problems now, then we're going to be forced into solutions that are painful for even more painful for everybody all across the state and all across the country.
Do you think the National Republican Party is a conservative party?
Yeah, I think they're more. I mean, I think the tax cuts have been fantastic for North Dakota, but I think spending has been out of control in Washington for a long, long time. And I think we need to start having serious conversations about how to bring that back under control.
Well, those tax cuts you referred to added approximately $2 trillion to the overall debt of the country. At least that's the guesstimate, if you will, from the perspective of now. So how is that fiscally conservative?
Well, I find one of the things I've always said, and I've said this during the course of this, you know, we continue to add to the deficit in different areas. And the one area primarily from the Democratic side of the aisle, the one time that they start concern themselves about those things is when you're putting more money in private citizens' pockets. But we're also experiencing, like we just talked about, I mean, we're 4.3% GDP. We're working forward. And North Dakota benefited more than any other state in the country from those tax cuts. And a lot of that has to do with the sound fiscal policy we did pass at the state level.
So the tax cut and the resulting increase in the debt and the resulting trade wars, those are kind of bumps in the road. But that doesn't mean that this isn't a conservative movement, I take it.
Well, yeah, I don't think the tax cut is a bump in the road at all for North Dakota. And I mean, and just to be clear, the last quarter in D.C., we collected more money than we ever have in the history of our country. We don't have a revenue problem in D.C. We have a spending problem. And one of the easiest ways to solve that is to let private citizens keep more of their money and continue to move forward.
Okay. Are you concerned about the possibility that well, this election is more a referendum on the guy who's in the White House than on the people who are running for office as you are?
No, I mean, I don't view things through that lens. People are going to vote. I mean, you never have the right to tell somebody why they're voting one way or how they're voting one way. You just have – the only thing you can do is get out, talk to as many people, but more importantly, listen to them. Listen to what their concerns are. And that's what we've been doing, especially considering – there's a top-ticket Senate race, not just in the state of North Dakota, but in the entire country going on in North Dakota right now.
Yes, that's for sure.
So the best cure to that for us and obviously is to get out and hit the highways, hit the county roads, and get to as many of these communities as possible and try and meet as many voters as we can.
Well, as you know, North Dakota is about as red a state as there is in the United States of America. But there has been some question raised about the energy, if you will, that Republicans might bring to the polls this November simply because of their concern about, you know, the turmoil in Washington, the question about Russians involved in the election, the president's tweets, and I guess some concern about leadership.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a national issue, but I can tell you from where we've at, even before I got into this race as state party chair, it's been North Dakotans are energized, Republicans are active. The events we've had from one end of the state to the other have been greatly attended. We're getting younger. We have more young people involved in the party than we ever have before, and I don't see that there's a drop off at all in the Republican Party in North Dakota.
Let me ask your opinion of a national issue that has just been prominent this, you know, in recent days here, and that is what's been going on in Washington in terms of the decision over the next person to sit on the United States Supreme Court. You are chair of the North Dakota State Senate's Judiciary Committee. What's your view of the way this is being handled?
I think the view of the way this is being handled is I feel bad for both of the witnesses. I don't think anybody is interested in the truth. And it started way before all of this happened. It started the first day of the hearings, and the attitude and the types, the manner in which questioning occurs, I would never let happen in my own committee. I can tell you that for sure. And it seems like there are people more interested in running for president than they are for asking questions and trying to get to what is the truth.
Well, just as a casual observer, I watched a fair amount of it yesterday and last night, and a concern, I think a legitimate concern, is the Supreme Court becoming overly politicized.
Yeah, I think the concern with everything right now in Washington is things are getting more and more partisan, and that's and I think that has been a trend that is occurring over the last several years prior to this administration. But I mean, it just seems we're trending that way, and that's one of the reasons I'm excited to get down there. You know, I've had the opportunity in North Dakota to serve in the legislature, and when it's time to stand on principle, I am more than comfortable doing that. But also have the ability to work with anybody if it's working towards getting large legislation passed that benefits North Dakota.
Well, the North Dakota legislature is a supermajority of Republicans. But let's talk a bit about bipartisanship because it is sorely lacking in our national political life, and there is less and less of it elsewhere as well. So, how important is that to Kelly Armstrong?
Yeah, I think building coalitions is the most important thing. You know, we talk about bipartisanship in North Dakota, but I mean, if you're trying to get a surge funding bill passed that's bringing $1.3 billion in infrastructure, and the most of it is going to end up in western North Dakota, it's not always a partisan coalition you're trying to build. It's a geographic coalition you're trying to build. And I think there are definitely areas in D.C. where that's important. I work with a Democrat representative from Iowa or a Republican representative from Wyoming if we're dealing on ag issues and energy issues that are important to those states. And that's what I think, especially in the House, because consuming states obviously have significantly more representation because of population than producing states. So we have to be able to build coalitions to work forward for issues that are important to North Dakota.
Well, the Farm Bill is a classic example of a bipartisan coalition kind of legislation that is, you know, worked for many years now. It's run into a little bit of friction, if you will. It, not that it often doesn't, but it does seem to be breaking down again on urban versus rural grounds. What's your solution for that kind of impasse?
You just need to continue to work with everybody and make them understand and help them understand how important these issues are for states like North Dakota.
Well, what I'm getting at here is that I think true conservatives in eastern states, urban states, might be saying, you know, why shouldn't we have a means test for somebody who's getting food stamps?
Yeah, I think those kind of conversations, I'm happy that they're occurring. I think it's unfortunate that they're occurring in the Farm Bill, and even though I believe those conversations should continue to occur, it's not worth holding up this Farm Bill for those issues. I mean, that's just how the reality of what happens and what we need out of those safety nets for our farmers and ranchers here. You know, I farm 6 miles south of Richardton, and if you'd put a pinprick in the epicenter of the drought last summer, it would be somewhere within 10 miles of where we were farming. We need crop insurance. We need a viable program moving forward. And we need now more than ever, given everything else that is going on, we need a long-term farm bill that gets passed through Congress.
Well, you are in support of a corporate farming law in North Dakota, something that the voters have turned down. And I think a judge just recently, shared an opinion about it. He didn't shoot it down. He didn't fully endorse it. But why are you so supportive of corporate farming in general?
I am not in support of corporate farming at all. I was in support of a very narrow carve-out that was brought to us by family dairy farmers in North Dakota, asking for help to be able to get access to capital and so that they could compete in the world marketplace. The bill that was brought forward only excluded dairy and hog farms, and it was brought to us by our family dairy farmers, and they needed help. They wanted something that could help them pass their family dairy farms on from generation to generation. But I respect the will of the voters, and even after that, we tried to do some more things that could help them out. We passed a bill that allowed them to exempt their equipment just like other farm equipment in the state. But we've seen it. You know, we've gone from 350 to 81 dairy farms in North Dakota. And at the same time, South Dakota, which has one of those narrow carve-outs, is their dairy industry is growing. So we were trying to help family dairy farmers. This was not an expansion of corporate farming that was going to allow Walmart to farm wheat in North Dakota.
Well, there were far more farmers than when I was a kid than there are now. There's just been a decline in the number of owners of farms, but the farmers have gotten big. The farms have gotten bigger.
Yeah, and I think economies of scale and technology and things of that nature impact family farmers the way they impact everybody else when we're doing business. And so even though North Dakota's thriving, we still have problems in a lot of our rural communities, and that's why we need to push for more value-added agriculture and continue to work for different things like that. You know, I've had the ability to tour ethanol plants in Castleton, Spiritwood, Richardson. We were at the AGT plant up in Minot yesterday, and we're doing some really fantastic things with value-added ag, and that's one way we can continue to help our family farmers here in the state.
One more question. Just how many more debates can we expect between you and Max Schneider, your DNPL opponent, before the election?
We've done four, I believe. I think four. And we have one more, I think, on with the Broadcasters Association. It's October 13th, I believe, maybe October 12th. I mean, my calendar gets squared away. But I know we have one more for sure, and that'll be televised. And at this point, I think that's the only one we've been invited to. So we'll continue to do them and work our way through. It's a great way to get our message out when we're competing with a lot of different things that are on TV right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for spending some time with us today.
No, I appreciate it.
Kelly Armstrong is a Republican candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. When Kelly Armstrong dropped by our studio last Friday, the North American Free Trade Agreement was in negotiation. Mexico had reached agreement with the U.S., but Canada's status was uncertain. Well, over the weekend, the U.S. and Canada came to terms, averting the collapse of NAFTA, but resulting in a new name. The pact will be renamed the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. President Trump has made rewriting trade agreements a priority. He reportedly wants Congress to quickly ratify the deal. However, lawmakers are not expected to vote on it until next year. Coming up on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
The International Artist Series of Minot presents Vocal Trash on Tuesday, October 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on the MSU campus. This urban-themed, Broadway-style production performs on custom instruments made from recycled materials rescued from landfills. The five-member green-minded troupe promotes peace and love through the universal language of song and dance. It's entertainment with a conscience. Ticket information is available online at minotconcerts.org or by phone at 701-838-1113.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The world is an amazing place with abundant natural wonders. Chuck Lura offers his observations about our part of the planet in his Natural North Dakota essays. Today, his attention turns to the sky for a fireworks show that will peak during the coming weekend, the Draconids Meteor Shower.
You may want to catch the weather forecast for October 6th to 10th. That's when the Earth passes through the debris field of Comet 21P Giacobini-Zinner, or what is more widely known as the Draconids Meteor Shower. This meteor shower is not one of the better shows. In fact, some observers call it a yawner, with maybe only five or so meteors an hour. But you never know with this meteor shower, and we'll be having a new moon on October 9th, so if the sky is clear, it should be about as dark and as good as it can get for viewing falling stars. Another plus for taking a closer look this year is that the comet is approaching its closest point to the sun in its orbit. That could mean more and brighter meteors. And unlike many other meteor showers that are best viewed in the middle of the night, the best viewing time for this shower is said to be nightfall or early evening hours. Still not convinced to check it out? Although the Draconids are generally a little ho-hum, they are known to occasionally put on a spectacular show. Maybe this year will be one of them. It's unpredictable, but the Draconids may occasionally and unexpectedly put on a dazzling display of meteors numbering in the hundreds or perhaps thousands per hour during the peak viewing period. The Draconids put on a spectacular display in 1933, 1946, and 2011 when over 600 meteors per hour were observed. Impressive shows also occurred in 98, 2005, and 2012. So it's definitely worth checking out, and you don't have to stay up late to do it. Although the Draconids run from October 6th to 10th, the peak viewing period is expected to be the early evening hours of October 7th or 8th. So consider taking the time to check out their Draconids. And don't fret, they're not portending gloom and doom. They're just very interesting and intriguing illuminations of comet material. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about legal assistance for immigrants and migrant workers in rural areas. And Ashley Thornburg hears about the life of women during the Age of the Vikings. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The search continues for five children of Fargo murder suspect Miguel Cooley of Fargo. Minnesota authorities say the children, ranging in age from 10 to 17, were taken by their mother, who defied a Clay County court order not to have contact with her children. Saturday night, 39-year-old Izetta Cooley came to a relative's home in Rose Creek, south of Austin, where the children were staying, and left with them. The state BCA issued a regional missing persons alert early yesterday, seeking assistance in finding them. Stephen Sandvik, senior sergeant investigator for the Mower County Sheriff's Department, says the tips have been coming in.
I'm not going to release what tips and where we've received them, because we haven't had any tips that have been relayed in a timely manner that would allow us to get boots on the ground and locate the vehicle. So I don't want people to think, oh, they're not in our area. We are staying open to her traveling literally anywhere.
Authorities say as a result of recent events, they have concerns for the children's welfare. Izetta Cooley is believed to be driving a black 2007 Suzuki with Minnesota license plate 103WJC. Anyone who sees the Cooley family is asked to call 911. Miguel Cooley was arrested at the relative's home in Rose Creek a week ago and remains in jail in Austin a day after he's accused in the fatal shooting of 20-year-old Gabriel Perez of Moorhead outside a fast food restaurant in downtown Fargo. North Dakota's fuel assistance program is ready to heat up for another season. Applications for those needing help in paying winter heating bills are available starting today online or at county social service agencies across the state. Last season, the program assisted 13,500 households, about 1,200 more than the previous year. Michelle G keeps tags of the federally funded effort for the North Dakota Human Services Department. G says the weather and fuel prices play a role in demand.
And we did see an increase in fuel costs from the prior heating season. Average temps, and we did a comparison from the prior heating season in the second half of this last heating season, we did see below average temperatures.
G says she's confident there will be adequate funding to meet the needs this winter.
About 70% of the participating households include people who are elderly or have disabilities or have children age 5 or younger. So it's truly meeting the most needy families in North Dakota.
North Dakota received some $20.5 million during the 2017 and 18 heating season. Eligibility is based on a household income, which must be at or below 60% of North Dakota's median. For example, a family of four can earn up to $55,444 a year. Both homeowners and renters are eligible for the program. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The search for legal assistance is challenging for immigrants and migrant workers in rural areas. They may have to travel hundreds of miles. They may run into people posing as attorneys. For Harvest Public Media, Chad Davis explores the difficulties people in Missouri and Illinois face and the solutions they might find.
On the east side of the Mississippi River is a small village of Cobden, Illinois. It's about half an hour from the college town of Carbondale. The village became a center for agriculture in the 1800s, and trains still transport crops out of the area. But the town has transitioned into a large community of southern Mexican immigrants. That's due in part to the large number of orchards bringing in farm workers. In 2010, the town's population was just over 1,000, with about 30% of its residents being of southern Mexican descent. But an unauthorized immigrant seeking a Spanish-speaking immigration lawyer might have to travel 30 minutes to Carbondale. And that's if they're lucky. Angie Gomez is the family services coordinator for Su Casa Head Start in Cobden.
People have to go as far as Chicago or St. Louis to find, you know, somebody that they, some attorneys they've been able to communicate, you know, with them. And so can you imagine how costly that is?
The American Immigration Lawyers Association, also known as ALA, represents immigration lawyers across the U.S. Immigration lawyer Ken Schmidt is a member of ALA and the founder of St. Louis-based U.S. Legal Solutions. He says immigration lawyers will sometimes travel to rural areas to meet clients, but the majority of ALA lawyers are located in metropolitan areas, including Missouri.
If you are a immigrant in those more southeastern area, southeastern Missouri, southern Illinois, southwestern Missouri area, and some of those places have very significant Latino populations, you're traveling quite a ways to seek help.
Schmidt says the increase in demand for lawyers in urban areas makes it difficult for lawyers to travel to rural areas. And traveling can present a danger to immigrants, especially if they come across federal immigration and custom enforcement agents.
But you might not be in removal proceedings. You might have a very legitimate basis for somebody to file a petition for you, and you're going to St. Louis to work on your case. You're at risk the whole way on the road to be pulled over for whatever reason and detained and possibly turned over to ICE for removal proceedings.
Schmidt says if lawyers are operating on an hourly basis, immigrants could pay up to hundreds of dollars. But the effect of not having access to credible legal representation creates another problem: fraud. The most common type? Notarios, individuals who emulate lawyers but don't necessarily have any legal background. Jennifer Ibanez Whitlock is an attorney and partner of Whitlock & Gray in St. Louis. She says in Latin America, notarios have the same responsibilities as lawyers. That often causes confusion when immigrants are seeking legal aid in the U.S.
Somebody gets their notary license, advertises themselves as such in English, and some Spanish-speaking immigrants will believe that that person somehow has some sort of legal training, but they really don't.
Whitlock, Schmidt, and many other lawyers agree the consequences of notarial fraud can be significant, including potential deportation. But Schmidt says several alternatives do exist for those with limited resources.
Places like Catholic Legal Immigration Project, like St. Francis Community Services Legal Services provides free legal services. The MICA Project provides low-cost representation or, you know, those type of places. But they have very limited resources.
For many unauthorized immigrants, the U.S. is now home. They hope the lack of access to the legal help they need won't take that away from them. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Chad Davis.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks into America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg finds out about Viking women warriors.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. When you hear the phrase Viking warrior, what comes to mind? Did you think of a pregnant woman or a woman at all? During her visit to Hostfest, Ashley Thornburg talked with Kelsey Patton, an instructor at the Scandinavian Youth Camp and a member of the Viking Village attraction at Hostfest. Kelsey teaches kids Viking arts and history.
What does an instructor do? Well, we got to have 18 children for 2 days, the weekend leading up to Hustfest, my husband and I. And we taught them how to write their name in Viking Age runes, how to play some Viking games, how to spin wool into yarn with a drop spindle, and how to make chainmail. And we also painted Viking shields.
And where did you learn the Viking arts?
I've been accumulating Viking arts almost my entire life. When I was 13, I told my mom that I wanted to knit a sweater, but first we had to get some sheep, and we got sheep. We actually got Icelandic sheep, which are the more or less the same sheep that the Vikings had. They were brought to Iceland in about the year 1000. They have not brought any new sheep to Iceland ever since then, so they are still the same pure bloodlines of the sheep that the Vikings brought over. And they're primitive sheep with horns and short tails, and they're really shaggy, woolly, and they're fun. Very smart.
So you are a purist.
Kind of. I don't actually spin and weave all the fabric for my own Viking clothing. I do live a modern life that makes that difficult, but I do have a pretty good collection of the skills. I know how to spin, I know how to weave, I know how to make the tablet woven trim, I know how to null bend the socks and mittens and make hats and things like that.
Are you all self-taught, or is this something that mom, grandma, great-grandma, grandfather? I'm not sure.
Well, see, my grandma passed away when my mom was very young. She was only about 5 years old. So my mom didn't learn how to do any of this from her mom. Her mom did know how to sew and know how to knit. As far as we know, she did. But my mom didn't learn those. And So my mom and I, we started experimenting when we got the sheep. We got a spinning wheel and a drop spindle, and we joke that it must have just been in our genetic memory because we just sat down and we did it. And other people we've tried to teach, and sometimes people really struggle when they're trying to learn, but we kind of seem to already know how. And my mom weaves. We have gone to some classes together, but mostly we've learned from books because we grew up out in rural Nebraska where there's not good internet. So my mom and I, we had to go with books because YouTube was not an option.
And it has led at least to something of a profession. Is this a full-time job for you? Are you able to sustain yourself doing the work that you do here at Husfest and in other places, and you have a store in Nebraska?
Yes, I have, like you said, I have a store in Nebraska. So my day job is going to my yarn store and selling yarn to customers and helping them with their spinning or weaving or knitting or crocheting questions. I teach classes, and then I also travel to events like the Husfest and fiber fairs and things like that to set up my booth and sell things. And I'll bring slightly different things to each event because a modern fiber fair gets a whole different range of products than the North Coast Fest, where I get things that are Viking related.
Sure. I suppose very different clientele.
Oh, yes. That's for sure. Because at a Viking Age event, everyone is very concerned with, well, is this historically accurate? Is this the material that they would have used? And I like to be able to provide those and say, yes, with certainty, this is the right kind. Like, I've got a lot of yarn here from my mom's sheep. So, yes, this is the wool that they would have had. But when you go to some other events, they just want pretty.
Do you find yourself similarly drawn to ancient and modern, or do you totally have a favorite?
I really have more of a favorite for historical textile crafts. I really love the knoll bending, and I really love the tablet weaving. That used to be my go-to sit down in front of the TV craft, was working on my tablet weaving. I also like to dabble in Victorian age knitting, which is a completely different type of knitting than modern American knitting. So anything historical I really like.
Always been good with your hands?
Yeah, pretty much. I've always loved to make things with my hands.
Well, another topic that I'm really interested in learning about beyond Viking arts is the Viking history. And specifically, we have a mutual friend, Tim Jorgensen, and he told me that you are fairly knowledgeable about Viking warriors. And specifically, I recently learned that a lot of Viking warriors were women whose bones were just originally identified as male because they're warriors. And then now there's further examination on the pelvises that says, no, these were women. And that's true. There were a lot that were women.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's definitely a possibility that there were women warriors. This original study that now has suddenly gained a lot of traction, they weren't looking specifically at, oh, these were warrior graves. They were looking at settler graves. And it turns out that a lot of the original colonists that were identified as men, because this was not in Scandinavia, they were women. So the women were definitely going with their men to the foreign lands. Now, how much are these women actually fighting? I don't know. Women had a lot of power in the Viking Age, aside from being warriors and aside from being fighters. There was, for example, women were in charge of all the stores of a farmhouse. So she had the key. She even wore a symbolic key to show that she was in charge of all the food and all the clothing and all of the material goods at the farm. And even her husband had to come ask her to open the store chest so that he could have anything or even to eat. If he was going to go on a trading mission, he had to ask her what he could bring to trade. The women were the ones who knew how to read and write, primarily. It was not a very typical men's thing to know the runes. Odin actually traditionally had to ask a woman for the runes to bring the knowledge of runes of writing to the rest of the world. And also women, you could not make a woman marry someone she did not want to, unlike in different eras of European history where marriages were arranged and you just announced to the woman who she's going to marry. Viking women had to give their consent. And basically the only thing a Viking woman couldn't do was represent herself in court. She had to have a male relative represent her in court. But she could still bring lawsuits if she could get one of her male relatives to do it. And it was kind of considered dishonorable if you refused to. If you refused your relative, it was kind of like, you better go represent her. Otherwise, you're going to look bad. She's going to make a fuss. So a lot of the reasons that we stereotypically have for women to cut their hair, disguise themselves as boys, and go out and be warriors, like, oh, she's trying to escape a bad marriage, or, oh, there's no prospects for her here. We don't have those in the Viking society, because women were already, they could independently own wealth, independently own their own farms, decide who they're going to marry. And really, I mean, I think there were some. I think there were some who did go off and fight. But I think it also took a great deal of courage just to go with as a settler or to follow the camp if the men were going and colonizing somewhere, or to stay at home when the men were off fighting, because then you're home alone. And raids were not just on England or on France. They were also on neighboring farmsteads.
Do you feel like the stories of these women are as well told as a lot of the stories of, you know, we have heard so much, I mean, especially in the United States, about like the pioneer spirit, and it just, you get a lot of stories of the men. And I feel like even in my family, studying some of the history, haven't come across these stories much. Did you have to dig out this information, or is it more well known and I'm just lazy about knowing this?
Well, there are stories about various Viking women in the sagas. Of course, these are written down a couple hundred years after the fact, and granted, the oral storytelling tradition was very strong. They didn't tend to lose as many details as we would now in telling the story and passing it on before it was written down. But I really do feel that women tend to get short shrift, because without women sitting at home spinning the wool for the sails for the Viking ships, you have no Viking raids. But we hear so much about the men that were on those ships and nothing about the women who were at home wondering if their men were ever going to come home. And wondering, okay, how are we going to survive the winter if they don't bring these things back? Okay, we better just farm just as hard as ever and manage the farmstead. And, you know, it's, but you don't hear their names and you don't hear their story. And I think that's really a shame, because throughout history, women have been just as important to the human race, and yet we seem to marginalize them unless they do something big and manly.
So do you feel you are just right in line with that lineage?
I kind of feel I am. I am really very content with showing the spinning and the weaving and telling people about this, because, you know, if you don't have women spinning and weaving, you have a lot of very cold, naked Viking men. They're not going to get very far. And you need the women who are going to milk the cows and feed the family. You need the women who are going to make the cheese and cook the grains and make the bread. And if you don't have all that, you have no culture, you have no society. And also, you know, the women, they sing the songs to the children. They learn the runes. They write down the household accounts. A lot of little rune writings that you find at archaeological sites are like little sticks with tell so-and-so to bring something home, or, you know, they're little notes, and a lot of them are probably written by women to other women, and, oh, here, go give this stick to so-and-so.
I know the Viking era encompasses a lot of time, but is there one or two women that you really just love to talk about, to tell people about?
Well, there's two that I do like to kind of juxtapose, and they are Gudrun and Freydis. And they are contemporaries. They lived at the same time. And they were both quite the adventurer. And even the sagas kind of compare and contrast them as a white woman and a red woman, or a good woman and a bad woman. Because Gudrun was, she was, at a young age, she and her family were shipwrecked. And Leif Erikson found her shipwrecked family on a random rock between Iceland and Greenland. And rescued them. And that was why he was called Leif the Lucky, because it was an incredibly lucky thing that he would find them. And she grew up and she married one of his contemporaries, and she went with him to the New World, to Vinland, and she gave birth to the first, as recorded, white child in North America, because she went when she was pregnant. And afterwards, later, you know, she and her family, they moved back to Greenland, and then later she moved to Iceland. She owned a farm. She built a church. Eventually, after her husband died, she and her son went on pilgrimage to Rome and came back. And she was buried in Iceland. You can actually go visit her grave. And so she's the one that's the good woman. And she got recorded in history. We actually know her name because she did some notable things, but she was also still very... She's a stereotypical Viking age woman. She takes care of her family. She does the spinning and the cooking, and she also owned land and was very influential. And then we have Freydis. Now, Freydis was Leif Erikson's half sister, illegitimate half sister, and she's the one that's sometimes described as the bad woman, because after Leif Erikson came back from the New World, Freydis and her husband decided that they wanted to lead an expedition over there. So she borrowed Leif Erikson's ship and she borrowed his homestead. He didn't actually give them to her. She borrowed them. And they teamed up with another boat full of Icelanders and they went to the New World. And they did a bunch of trading, and they didn't get along as well with the Native Americans as the first group. And one day, Freydis, and it was late fall, she was about 8 months pregnant. She and some of the men were out in the woods, and tensions had been high with the natives. And so the men were wearing their armor and they had their swords, and they were gathering berries. And suddenly they were attacked and they go running through the woods. All the men are hightailing it, leaving Freydis behind because she can't keep up because she's pregnant. So then, eventually, one of the men was shot and fell down dead. So she picked up her sword, turned around to face all the natives that were running at her, and ripped open her dress and slapped herself with the flat of the sword and screamed at them. And then they're all like, oh, she is crazy, and they ran away. So, you know, there we see, okay, this is laudable. She's quite brave.
We don't say mother bear for no reason.
No, we really don't. But then it is rather unfortunate that that legacy of her being such a brave mother bear became tarnished, because in the spring when they're getting ready to leave, well, she was having an affair with one of the Icelanders. And she came into bed one morning with cold, wet feet because she had not put her shoes on. And her husband asked what had been going on, and she told him a story about how she had been arguing with one of the Icelanders and he wanted to give her his boat and take Leif's boat, and she didn't want him to, which... it's kind of weird because his boat was known to be the bigger, better boat. Well, then her husband said, oh, well, we can't have this. So he and his men went and killed all the Icelander men. And there were 6 Icelander women, and they said, well, we can't kill the Icelander women. Well, Freydis didn't want the word to get around of what had happened, so she killed them herself with an axe. And then they sank Leif Erikson's boat in the harbor, and they took the Icelander's boat back to Greenland. But the other women that were with started talking around and saying what had been going on. And Eric, her father, who was the leader of the Greenland colony, he got word of what had happened, so he banished her.
That is not where I thought that story was going.
Nope. Plot twist.
Where is that Hollywood movie?
I know, really? There are so many fantastic things from history. And yet we just keep getting remakes. And then sometimes there's really good stories and they leave out the really good parts.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
That was Norsk Høstfest Youth Camp instructor Kelsey Patton. When she isn't channeling her inner Viking, Patton runs the yarn store, Spindle, Shuttle, and Needle, in Stromberg, Nebraska. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 1st. North Dakota has a long and unfortunate history of prairie fires. In 1804, Lewis and Clark recorded a prairie fire that resulted in fatalities. Clark wrote of several people who could not get to any place of safety. Lightning sometimes caused wildfires, but they were also caused by human activity. In 1805, the explorers noted that it was common for the Indians to burn the prairie near their villages to benefit their ponies and the buffalo. But sometimes these fires got out of control, leaving destruction in their wake. The plains were especially vulnerable to fire in the fall, after the dry weather of summer and before fall rains came. But not all the fires occurred on the plains. Wooden buildings stood close together in many North Dakota towns, leaving entire blocks vulnerable to a fire. Fargo suffered the worst fire in its history in July of 1893. The fire started in the rear of Herzman's Dry Goods Store and swept through the city. By the time the fire was brought under control, about 160 acres were in ashes, 140 homes, and 219 businesses were destroyed. In Bismarck, a large portion of the town was wiped out in 1898 by a fire that originated in the agent's office of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Losses amounted to almost $800,000, with insurance covering only about $250,000. A 1907 fire in Willow City destroyed 16 businesses, with a loss of about $115,000. The fire started early in the morning, and by the time it was discovered, the wind had blown it into a raging blaze. Firefighters came from Bottineau to help. About half the losses were covered by insurance. On this date in 1909, the Golden Valley Chronicle announced that the town of Beach would move into a new era with the construction of a modern brick building. The Lovell brothers had lost their hardware and implement business to a fire just a few weeks earlier. They quickly made plans to construct a new two-story building made of brick. It would cost $6,000 and was said to be fireproof. Great stacks of bricks had been delivered to the site. The construction would be complete in 30 days. The businessmen planned to follow that construction with another brick building downtown in the spring. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Trump celebrates a new free trade deal with Mexico and Canada.
We don't take it as a privilege. It's a privilege for them to do business with us. And I'm not talking about Mexico. I'm talking about everybody. Everybody.
But what does that mean as trade wars continue? How trade may be changing? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, another conversation with a statewide candidate. Tomorrow we'll visit with Joshua Boshi. He's seeking election as North Dakota Secretary of State. And Anastasia Higginbotham writes and illustrates books for children, and she is not afraid to tackle big issues. Her previous books have helped parents talk to their kids about death, divorce, and sex. And on Tuesday, we'll learn about her latest book. The title is Not My Idea, a book about whiteness. So I hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.